This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Center for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Louis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village.
On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm thrilled to share the proceedings of the 13th annual Ernie O'Malley Lecture, which actually took place 11 years ago now in 2011. And in this talk by Professor Angela F. Murphy, she looks at the memories of abolitionists of Daniel O'Connell in the United States. The title of her talk was, Though Dead, Yet He Speaketh, Abolitionist Memories of Daniel O'Connell in the United States. It's a fascinating lecture, and I thought it was a fine way for us to officially mark the beginning of Black History Month in the United States. Angela gives a really scintillating account of how Daniel O'Connell's memorialized or memories are created around him, particularly in abolitionist circles and beyond. A really interesting and fraught time in American history. And of course, Daniel O'Connell as a global figure of distinction in terms of his stature, his reputation as someone who was seen as really an international figure with regard to social justice and human rights. And as I said, there's no fitting way for us to mark the beginning of Black History Month by pulling this wonderful nugget out of the archives. So enjoy, folks. Again, it's Angela F. Murphy on Abolitionist Memories of Daniel O'Connell.
So I want to start by talking about something very recent, and that is Obama's recent visit to Ireland, in which he made a big kind of play about his own Irish roots. His great-great-great-grandfather, Fulmuth Kearney, was a Protestant bootmaker from Monegal County who immigrated to the United States in 1850, part of the famine migration. And the president referenced this connection throughout his visit, and the Irish people made kind of great pay out of it as well. He gave a speech at College Green in Dublin while he was there, introducing himself. My name is Barack Obama of the Monegal Obamas, and I've come home to find the apostrophe that we lost somewhere along the way. His speech went on to address the way in which the United States and Ireland were connected, with the usual interest on the contributions of Irish immigrants to the United States. But in addition, Obama drew attention to another connection that reflected his own particular background. He paid tribute to Daniel O'Connell, the iconic 19th century leader in Ireland, best known for his achievements on behalf of Catholic emancipation and for Irish repeal, the movement for trying to assert a parliamentary independence from Great Britain. Best known for that, but it was his importance in another area that Obama emphasized, the transatlantic agitation to end slavery and color prejudice. So speaking for Americans, Obama said, and I'm going to quote, when we strove to blot out the stain of slavery and advance the rights of man, we found common cause with your struggles against oppression. Frederick Douglass, an escaped slave and our great abolitionist, forged an unlikely friendship right here in Dublin with your great liberator, Daniel O'Connell. His time here, Frederick Douglass said, defined him not as a color, but as a man, and it strengthened the nonviolent campaign he would return home to wage. Douglass was very impressed with the fact that he could walk around in Ireland and not experience the disdain he did in the United States, and he spent much of the rest of his life referencing that feeling in Ireland. For Obama, the relationship between O'Connell and Douglass connected two great historical struggles associated with his own identity as an African-American and as an American with Irish roots. And Davy had spoken of the interactions between the two men previously at a St. Patrick's Day reception. He gave great history of the repeal movement and Daniel O'Connell and his connection with Frederick Douglass. And during the Irish visit, the memory of O'Connell's legacy loomed large. After his speech, O'Connell was slated to make a visit at O'Connell's tomb. He was not able to do this because there was a volcanic ash cloud that was present from the eruption in Ireland, and so he had to hightail it out of there so he didn't get stuck, I guess. So he was not able to do that, but interestingly, just before his visit at the tomb, there had been another meeting, just, you know, a couple weeks before he arrived. There was a big celebration of Frederick Douglass at O'Connell's tomb. In order to celebrate a new edition of Frederick Douglass's famous narrative of his life as a slave, his great-great-granddaughter, Nettie Douglass, laid a wreath on O'Connell's crypt at an event held to mark the publication of the edition, and she was met at the gravesite by the great-great-great-granddaughter of O'Connell, Anne Quinlan. So it's quite an event. During these events, the Irish press made much about the forgotten legacy of O'Connell's anti-slavery commitments. Some of the American press did as well. But historians in recent years have actually given quite a bit of attention to the Irish liberator's anti-slavery legacy. They've stressed not only his interactions with Frederick Douglass, but all of his activities have drawn attention. Modern scholars, including myself, there have been others who've written about this subject in very, you know, kind of interesting way too, have discussed his involvement in the abolition of slavery and apprenticeship in Great Britain. He was very much involved in the parliamentary decisions that ended slavery and apprenticeship in the West Indies. But his attacks on American slavery have been of particular interest to American historians, because in the way he actually really influenced American abolitionists, and also because of the dilemma he presented for Irish Americans who lifted him up as a hero and really wanted to support him, but at the same time wanted to gain acceptance in American society, abolitionism wasn't so popular. So it really presented a dilemma, and one of the big questions that historians have been interested in, and really the main subject of the book I wrote, was, you know, why they had such an anti-abolitionist sentiment. In recent decades, then, O'Connell's anti-slavery activities have been duly considered, but it's not so true of the early 20th century. Like most aspects of our nation's history of slavery and anti-slavery, his commitment to abolitionism was largely ignored by white historians during the Jim Crow years of the late 19th and early 20th century. They kind of were rediscovered after the Civil Rights Movement, and people started becoming more interested in it again. But if one goes back to the decades just after O'Connell's death in 1847, there's evidence that O'Connell's abolitionist reputation loomed very large in the United States during the years of the sectional crisis, Civil War, and Reconstruction. Modern memories of O'Connell's anti-slavery legacy, in fact, are built largely on those created by abolitionists, Irish Americans, and African Americans during those years. While each of these groups remembered O'Connell in different and sometimes oppositional ways, they all addressed his dedication to ending slavery. Discussion of O'Connell's anti-slavery legacy emerged among these groups in connection with several goals, and I'm going to kind of highlight three of them. One, at times O'Connell's words were an appeal to the Irish-American population to support the anti-slavery movement. Irish-Americans had become increasingly powerful during these years as this Democratic voting bloc, as more and more came to American shores, and abolitionists hoped to raise their consciousness so that their vote didn't continue to strengthen the slave power of the United States, and that was the term that was used widely at the time, the slave power. The Irish-American community was notoriously anti-abolitionist in sentiment, but they remained enthusiastically loyal to the memory of O'Connell, who had promoted both Catholic emancipation successfully and the repeal of the legislative union between Ireland and Great Britain unsuccessfully. Abolitionists therefore lifted up O'Connell's words with the hope that they would affect Irish-American opinion on slavery. Unfortunately, they achieved little success in doing this, and we're going to during the antebellum and Civil War years especially. So we're going to discuss that. Also, a second way in which his memory was evoked concerns his methodology. His powerful oratory, his brilliant manipulation of public opinion in Ireland and beyond its borders, his skill in creating an intricate organization on behalf of his cause, and in his insistence in using peaceful means in his agitation for Irish and Catholic rights, all served as a model for other reformers, including those that were concerned with black rights in America. During his lifetime, O'Connell himself hinted that he understood that his methodology would be part of his legacy, And speaking of American slavery, he proclaimed in 1835 that what African Americans really needed was some black O'Connell to agitate on their behalf. When Frederick Douglass visited Ireland in 1845, O'Connell introduced the black abolitionist as one who had earned this title, and he kind of gave him that nickname, the Black O'Connell, and others did as well. After O'Connell's death, African American leaders would continue to draw parallels between O'Connell's movement for Irish uplift and their own struggle for racial justice in the United States. So that's the second thing we'll be looking at. A third was that the American Anti-Slavery Society, abolitionists that were connected with William Lloyd Garrison, and when I speak of Garrisonian abolitionists, these are the ones I was talking about, they're kind of the most radical of the abolitionists, demanding immediate unconditional end of slavery with no compromise. And they were quite controversial during their day. And so when I talk about the Garrisonian abolitionists, that's who I'm talking about. So the third thing I'm going to be looking at is how the Garrisonian abolitionists lifted up O'Connell as an example in the years after his death. And in particular, it's kind of interesting, yes, they used O'Connell to try to entreat Irish Americans to join in with the anti-slavery movement, but they also used him to confront other leaders and reformers who had at one time spoken against slavery, but who had started to backpedal as the sectional crisis heated up. And so they lifted up O'Connell as someone who would not compromise his goals and kind of threw him in the face at all of these other people as sort of a rebuke. So I'm going to look at that a little bit. And it was really this effort between 1847 and the Civil War that kind of really cemented his legacy as an abolitionist in American history. I think without the abolitionists printing so many of O'Connell's words and referencing him so many times, that legacy might not have had such a strong historical footprint that we can follow. So during this talk, I'm going to address each of these. First, I'm going to look at the abolitionists in the Anti-Slavery Society during the antebellum era. Second, I'm going to move on to a discussion of Irish Americans and how they were confronted with his legacy. And third, I'm going to look at African American references to O'Connell among African American groups, with some specific attention to Frederick Douglass, since he's kind of the most well-known African American leader that's associated with him. And I'll end with a discussion of the way in which these three groups came together in a really remarkable way in 1875. In August 1875 was the centennial celebration of Daniel O'Connell's birth. And there were celebrations all over. And interestingly, even though a lot of these groups were in conflict with each other, well, Irish Americans were in conflict with these other two groups, they all came together and celebrated together in 1875. And after that, you do see some leaders of both the Irish American and the African American community increasingly try to tie their causes together in America. So I'm going to take you to that point by exploring some of the ways he's been remembered. So first, I want to look at abolitionist memories. American abolitionists associated with Garrison were largely responsible for keeping his memory alive in the immediate aftermath of O'Connell's death. During the 1840s and the last years of O'Connell's life, members of the American Anti-Slavery Society and other organizations publicized O'Connell's speeches against American slavery in order to draw attention to their cause. They continued to do so after O'Connell's death in 1847 as the sectional crisis over slavery heated up in the United States and well into the war years of the 1860s. On at least nine occasions, The Liberator, which was the primary newspaper of William Lloyd Garrison and the American Anti-Slavery Society, had whole editions that reprinted selections from O'Connell's speeches on slavery. So he came up again and again. Anytime they had an excuse, they reprinted his words. And they also brought up a lot of his quotations and such in resolutions at anti-slavery meetings. He was discussed at those meetings a lot. In speeches, they produced pamphlets as well for sale. They were quite attached to the memory of O'Connell during these years. So Garrisonian abolitionists set the tone for how they'd use O'Connell's memory and the tributes they printed after his death on May 15, 1847. The first notice of his death in The Liberator called him the champion of Ireland and of universal freedom. Resolutions of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society were printed in The Liberator stating that while many would remember O'Connell as an Irish nationalist, they would remember him in a broader context as a friend of mankind who promoted who promoted anti-slavery and joined in common cause with the lovers of progress throughout all the world. So what they're trying to do is create sort of an image of O'Connell as a cosmopolitan reformer, and have people remember him beyond what he did for Ireland. Not just for anti-slavery, but for uplift of mankind in general. They would talk about his efforts on behalf of universal man quite often. So these sentiments reflected essential themes that would appear in The Liberator and other newspapers when O'Connell was referenced over the decade. They praised O'Connell because although his position on slavery was widely criticized throughout the American South and might have cost him Southern support for his Irish repeal movement, he never tempered his views in order to appease the supporters of slavery. And it was this position that made him a very useful example for American abolitionists. For the abolitionists, O'Connell represented someone whose dedication to nation, in his case the Irish nation, did not supersede his commitment to mankind as a whole. He was thus an example that served the cosmopolitan attitude of the Garrisonian abolitionists, the perfect hero for the columns of The Liberator, whose masthead read, "Our country is the world, our countryman, all mankind." O'Connell's position on slavery had always been closely aligned to the Garrisonian point of view, and his words, as I mentioned before, had often been in The Liberator before his death. As O'Connell's activism for repeal attracted attention to the United States while he was alive, abolitionists seized the opportunity to publicize his position on slavery, and O'Connell gave them plenty of ammunition. Much of the speeches he made, by the way, were in direct response to abolitionist inquiries and encouragement to speak out on the subject. He would respond to letters and such that came to him. A central theme in his rhetoric was an attack on American hypocrisy. He frequently lamented while the United States claimed to be a nation that valued liberty, its citizens allowed millions of slaves to be held in the South. He was very frustrated because he wanted to lift up the United States as an example to Ireland, but he felt like he couldn't do it in all good consciousness when they had this problem of slavery and a lack of democracy there. So he was very frustrated about that. And hypocrisy was one theme. He also said a lot of the excuses about not being able to attack slavery, particularly from the Irish-American population, was because it would go against the Constitution. The Constitution was arranged along this compromise concerning slavery, and he always attacked that point of view. He would go reference the Declaration of Independence as preceding the Constitution, and he would talk about the power of amendment, and he would talk about the ability of the federal government to address slavery in federal territories in Washington, D.C. So he would always address some of these specific arguments as well. He frequently lamented that while the United States claimed to be a nation that valued liberty, its citizens allowed millions of slaves to be held in the South. O'Connell rejected claims that slavery could not be ended because of racial shortcomings among the slave population. And like the Garrisonians, he called for an immediate, unconditional end to American slavery and for black and white equality. And he condemned not just the slave owners, but any who did not fight and speak out against the American system of slavery. So if you weren't an abolitionist, you were dead to him. O'Connell's outspoken criticism of American slavery made him an important ally of American abolitionists, and the Garrisonians were eager to claim him, O'Connell, as one of their own. And they spread certain legends about him, some true, some maybe a little bit fanciful. But certain legends sprung up in abolitionist literature that was much repeated, and you still see repeated in a lot of the histories today, about his unswerving commitment to the slave and to universal freedom. Abolitionists, for example, often refer to O'Connell's refusal to visit the United States due to the presence of slavery in the nation. They also discuss his tendency to snub any slave-owning American that appeared across the Atlantic. Upon introduction to a visitor from the United States, the saying went that O'Connell would ask if the person owned slaves or supported slavery, and if he received an affirmative answer, he refused to shake their hand. So any American had to kind of have those abolitionist credentials before he would greet them. Another often told tale concerned his rejection of support from the West Indian interest in Parliament. During the debates over the emancipation of slaves in the West Indies, there is a claim that O'Connell was approached by the West Indian interest and told that they would basically exchange votes on behalf of Irish uplift if he would back off of supporting and into slavery and apprenticeship. And O'Connell rejected their overture. There's a quote that's often associated with this in the literature. Though it should be a blow against Ireland, he said, it's a blow in favor of human liberty. Abolitionists lifted up this episode as one example of the way in which O'Connell refused to sacrifice his ideals for political expediency. Another of his positions was used to illustrate his consistency was an assertion that he would not be bribed into silence by money for repeal from Southern slave owners. Abolitionists were frequently referred to a statement that bloodstained money sent from slave owners would not change his opinion on slavery. That's a true statement. It's kind of been conflated in later years. Some of the abolitionists in their memories later on said that he returned money to the Southern states. And in fact, it's kind of been repeated in the historical literature. I read an article only published last week, I believe, that made that claim. And he did not return any money to the Southern states because of slavery. He kept the money. but he said he would not let the money change his opinion on slavery. And if they were willing to support repeal, even though he's, you know, anti-slavery, that's fine. But he did keep the money. He did return money, though, to one Louisiana association. This is probably where that kind of idea comes from. That had said that they promoted violent resistance to Great Britain. And he felt he had to return that money because he was very, very careful to emphasize that his was a peaceful movement. So that's one of those things that have kind of been attached to him over time. The last element of the O'Connell myth was his participation in the Irish anti-slavery address that crossed the Atlantic in 1842. This address was actually penned by Garrisonian abolitionists, some from Ireland that supported the Garrisonians and some from the United States. And it was sent around, and eventually 70,000 Irish men and women signed this address to Irish Americans saying, come support the anti-slavery movement. O'Connell signed it, but because his signature, and Father Matthew, Theobald Matthew, the temperance leader, also did, because of their signatures, their names were associated with it, and it was often called O'Connell's address in the United States. And the abolitionists never corrected that. They lifted it up as his address. He was merely a signatory. He supported it, but he didn't pen it. It's important to note, though, and this is kind of interesting, although the Garrisonians saw O'Connell as an important ally, O'Connell and the Garrisonians didn't see eye to eye on all matters during his lifetime. And in fact, O'Connell always resisted formal association with the American Anti-Slavery Society. A lot of times when he spoke out to the Irish to say, support the anti-slavery movement, he would say, but not the real fanatics. He was very worried about that reputation, and so he never really kind of endorsed the Garrisonians in quite the way that Garrison and his people wanted them to. He and their society also clashed concerning religion, and in 1843, Garrison O'Connell exchanged heated words that centered on anti-Catholic statements that were made by certain abolitionists and on O'Connell's critiques of Garrison's own anti-clerical views. So they had a real heated exchange in 1843 where it was pretty serious. But then, even though they were disagreeing in this matter, whenever O'Connell would speak out against slavery, they're like, we can still use this. And so they kind of would brush it under the rug. But there were some debates there. After his death, O'Connell would be lifted up as an uncompromising advocate for the slave, even though during his lifetime, Garrisonian abolitionists often criticize him for not going far enough. For example, although financial support for Irish repeal from the South never prevented him from speaking out against slavery, support for slavery among the Southern supporters of repeal never prompted him to actually return any of the bloodstained money, and they mentioned that a few times to him, saying that he should make an example by doing that. Some abolitionists were quite critical. Wendell Phillips, who I'll mention a few times here, he was actually one of the men abolitionists, he was associated with Garrison, that most often lifted up O'Connell in the years after his death. And in fact, one of his most famous speeches was a speech on Daniel O'Connell, kind of a memory of him that he gave throughout the 1870s and 1880s. But Wendell Phillips actually, he said, you know, he won't shake hands with slaveholders, no, but he will shake their gold. I mean, he was quite critical. Abolitionists also criticized O'Connell for giving expressions of thanks to Robert Tyler, a slave-owning son of John Tyler, the president in the 1840s, who was a prominent supporter of O'Connell's repeal movement in the United States. In addition, when O'Connell's son Maurice and his repeal colleague Thomas Steele made plans to visit the United States in order to promote Irish legislative independence, they said they wouldn't speak out against slavery while they were here because they didn't feel it was their place to do so. So the Garrisonians charged them, all of the repealers, really, with selfishly abandoning the slave for the cause of Ireland. The Liberator printed a critique of O'Connell's miserable political expediency in allowing his son to visit and ignore this issue of slavery. That last critique was enough, and the visit never took place. They decided it wasn't necessary to go after all. Despite all of this controversy, though, it was the memory of O'Connell's refusal to remain quiet on slavery that the abolitionists promoted in the years after his death. Whatever his faults, a memorial in the Liberator proclaimed, he was never bribed into silence by the Southern slaveholders. And it was this legacy that made him a useful symbol for the abolitionists who wished to combat the spirit of compromise that threatened their vision of a nation and of a world that would be free of slavery. O'Connell's anti-slavery commitments were invoked time and again throughout the decades as other leaders who had at one time spoken out against slavery began to temporize on the subject during the 1840s and 1850s. Various individuals were held in comparison with O'Connell in the pages of Garrison's Liberator, and they were found wanting. Among those found recreant were American politician Daniel Webster, Irish Catholic temperance leader Father Theobald Matthew, Hungarian freedom fighter Louis Kossuth, and French Huguenot minister Frederick Menard. When Daniel Webster urged obedience to the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 for the sake of union, the abolitionists compared him unfavorably to O'Connell. When Father Matthew and Hungarian nationalist Louis Kossuth visited American shores during the 1840s and 50s, they both refused to reiterate anti-slavery views that they had expressed on the opposite side of the Atlantic. And again, abolitionists compared them to O'Connell. When Menard urged American religious organizations to avoid discussion of slavery in order to avoid fracturing those organizations, again, O'Connell's legacy was put to use. So during the years between 1847 and the beginning of the American Civil War, as the sectional controversy over slavery heated up through the nation, O'Connell's memory was evoked as a rebuke to each of these leaders who at one point condemned slavery but found themselves backpedaling on the issue, interfered with their own particular cause. In this way, abolitionists constructed a memory of Daniel O'Connell, that served their agenda in the years after their death, his death. Under the custodianship of the abolitionists, Daniel O'Connell became the example of the uncompromising reformer, the philanthropist who promoted human rights broadly defined. In the commemorative representations of O'Connell during the years following his death, American abolitionists had created a mythic figure who embodied the highest abolitionist values. And although during his lifetime, O'Connell sometimes disappointed them, the Garrisonian abolitionists, by not going far enough, and sometimes they criticized him for not having a stronger commitment to the slave, that he often preferred Ireland instead of supporting slavery. What they remembered after his death was his refusal to be silent on slavery no matter what. And this unwillingness allowed the abolitionists to lift him up in contrast to those who abandoned anti-slavery principles out of political expedience, and it converted him in their memories from an Irish nationalist leader who took a stand against slavery to something larger. He became a cosmopolitan reformer, a philanthropist who had overcome the prejudice of patriotism, who would not work for the uplift for a single people, but for the good of all mankind. So the abolitionists really preserved this memory of Daniel O'Connell, like I said, became useful not only to them, but later on, after the Civil Rights Movement, he's invoked for his anti-slavery commitments as well. All right, the next topic I want to talk about, though, are how the Irish Americans dealt with a lot of these reprintings of O'Connell's views. So during the years of the Civil War, Irish Americans interacted with his anti-slavery legacy in a whole different way. Irish Americans, in fact, were the target of a lot of O'Connell's anti-slavery rhetoric. And in speeches made throughout the 1840s, O'Connell often called on them to join with the abolitionists. When they rejected the call, he would criticize them and say they weren't true Irishmen because of their views. Irish Americans continued to lift up and kind of revere O'Connell. Despite this, they just kind of swept it under the rug and tried to ignore his anti-slavery views, or they would say, he didn't really know what it's like here, so we're just going to focus on his efforts on behalf of Ireland and for Catholics, and he's still a great man. He just is mistaken here, and we're just not going to talk about it. It's kind of what they did. As they had during the last year of O'Connell's life, Garrisonian abolitionists tried to use his words to draw Irish Americans into the anti-slave movement and to serve him up his words up as a rebuke whenever they expressed anti-abolitionist sentiments. Abolitionists were especially active in discussing O'Connell's criticisms of slavery after the arrival to American shores of exile John Mitchell, who had split from the repealers. He's more radical. He was very critical of O'Connell for not going far enough with Ireland. He was exiled and made his way from Tasmania to the United States eventually in 1853. And when he arrived in the United States, he became a very prominent Irish nationalist spokesman, but he also was a pro-slavery spokesman as well. He became a very big supporter of slavery, and he wrote quite a bit not only attacking the abolitionists, but espousing the idea that slavery was in fact a positive good and that it benefited both the black and the white man. That was his view. So he defended slavery in his New York paper that he edited after his arrival, and he eventually moved to Alabama and started a paper there called The Southern Citizen. It was a pro-Confederacy, pro-slavery newspaper. One of his sons died fighting for the Confederacy during the war. So Mitchell he had very inflammatory rhetoric. And in one infamous exchange with Irish abolitionist James Houghton, who was associated both with O'Connell and with the Garrisonian abolitionists, he had written to Mitchell when he arrived to American shores and said, "Speak out against slavery." And Mitchell wrote him this really angry letter back and published it in his newspaper. And he lambasted him for his, quote, "violent sympathy with the fat Negroes of America," unquote, while he was, quote, "in the midst of the most hideous and ignominious, slavery that ever deformed the world," unquote, in Ireland. American abolitionists publicized this exchange in their papers, placing Mitchell in contrast to O'Connell. And, of course, they were challenging Irish Americans to take O'Connell's side rather than Mitchell's. Most of the Irish American press continued to maintain an anti-abolitionist stance. Why? Well, the Irish Americans first, they believed that abolitionism was a threat to the American Union, and that they also believed that the agitation against Southern slavery was unconstitutional, and they felt like we're new citizens to this great nation where we're getting kind of a better deal. We don't want to go trying to dismantle that. So they're very careful about that. In addition, this was a period of rampant nativism against Irish Americans. It would not have been a popular stand to take the side of the abolitionists. And so they really couldn't do so without being holding themselves up as being a bigger, even bigger problem than people thought they were to the American Republic. In addition, they found strength in the Democratic Party, which took the side of anti-abolition and did not attack slavery. So that as well. So even the abolitionists were deemed a threat to the Union, but even when the Republican Party arose in the 1850s with a more moderate, you know, non-expansion of slavery into the Western territories, they didn't support that either because of their Democratic leanings. So they had a lot of reasons for resisting the anti-slavery movement. And one reason why they've gotten such kind of a hard rap for their anti-abolitionist sentiments, is because they were indeed singled out. If you think about almost any other group in American society, they probably would have had similar arguments. When the Civil War broke out, Irish Americans supported the Union effort. They rose up and fought under Lincoln's armies, but most of them continued to criticize abolitionists. Two of the most influential Irish papers in the Northeast, the Boston Pilot and the New York Freeman Journal, portrayed the abolitionists as just as responsible for the war as the Southern secessionists. They kind of saw them as the opposite end of the other side of the coin, that these kind of fanatics on both sides were causing the Civil War. And so that's the opinion that was expressed in those papers. The Freeman's Journal was a harsh critic of the Lincoln administration and blamed the growing spirit of anti-slavery in the North as a primary reason, and the Pilot assigned equal culpability to both. In its editorials, the Pilot expressed concern that abolitionists continued to be a threat during the war. Wendell Phillips was quite outspoken about the fact that he thought the war needed to be a war to end slavery and not just for Union. And they argued that Wendell Phillips, by trying to encourage the war to be shifted towards emancipation, was actually committing treason. And they insisted that he be arrested. So they were really fearful of these abolitionist spokesmen and emancipation keeping the Union apart. And, of course, when Lincoln pushed the Emancipation Proclamation out there, it was presented as an effort to bring an end to the war by denying the slave population to the Southern effort. But the pilot said, no, it's going to keep the war going because the South will never, ever agree to reunion now that we've attacked slavery. So they worried that they were fracturing the nation beyond repair. And so there's constant. If you look through the newspapers from that era, the 1860s, 2 and 3, especially after Emancipation Proclamation was issued, there's just this constant anti-abolitionist talk throughout those papers. But there was a dissenting voice among the Catholic press in the North. There was one Catholic paper in all the North that took a strong abolitionist stance, and that was in Cincinnati. The Cincinnati Catholic Telegraph, that was edited by Father Edward Purcell, who is the younger brother of Cincinnati Archbishop John Baptist Purcell, who's the first Archbishop of Cincinnati, was the only Catholic paper to vigorously oppose slavery during the war. Its editorials reflected the opinion of the Archbishop, who had become increasingly outspoken against slavery and supportive of the Republican Party after the Southern states seceded from the Union. The Telegraph soon became embroiled in an editorial war with the Boston Pilot, the New York Freeman's Journal, and other Northeastern Irish Catholic papers on the subject of slavery and abolition in 1863, as they were increasingly criticized for their position in support of emancipation. The Pilot, for example, proclaimed that the Telegraph professed a, quote, Negrophily, I guess that's how you pronounce it, almost as violent as that of Wendell Phillips, unquote. And it continued to argue that the central concern of the Northern citizenry should be that of union. The notorious draft riots here in New York, a week of rioting in New York City in which members of the Democratic Party, many of them Irish American, protested emancipation and the Republican Party's conscription policy, with attacks on Republican symbols throughout the city, including African Americans. Lasted a week. It was the worst, longest lasting draft riots in American history. Brought was a backdrop to all of these arguments. I mean, these editorials are happening at the same time that you have, these draft riots taking place. The Boston Pilot comes out and they're trying to kind of smooth things over and saying, this war is for union, we support Lincoln as long as it's for union, and kind of trying to focus on that unionist speech. But the Catholic Telegraph used the opportunity to reprint some words of O'Connell about anti-slavery in response to those draft riots. They reprinted a copy of a letter that O'Connell had sent a repeal association in Cincinnati back in 1843, 20 years before. And this is actually quite famous letter. This letter to the Cincinnati repealers is one of O'Connell's most comprehensive arguments against American slavery, and he also was very critical of Irish Americans who supported slavery in the North. He was kind of shocked because he had received this letter from Cincinnati defending slavery, and he had expected it from the Southern repealers, but not so much from the North. And so he responded with this very long, drawn-out letter that now they're reprinting in the paper. And is quite critical of Irish Americans, and I could quote, another 20 minutes, some of the statements he made, but basically one of them is that the volunteer defenders of slavery, he said, would find no sympathy nor support from native, uncontaminated Irishmen. The Telegraph also placed a signed copy of the address on display in its office, and they printed a pamphlet copy of the speech for distribution. And you can find copies of these in libraries throughout the nation. And again, these pamphlets have been like one of the pieces of evidence people have used for O'Connell's anti-slavery sentiments in years afterwards. The New York Freeman's Journal and the Boston Pilot and the Irish press did not like this very much. And you kind of get this idea of how they're dealing with O'Connell's words and their responses. The New York Freeman's Journal commented on the Telegraph's attempt to revive memories of O'Connell's anti-slavery agitation by pointing out that O'Connell's anti-slavery sentiments had never had an impact on the Irish-American position on slavery, and noted that, quote, as the time has passed on, they have desired to drop the incident from the memory of their great countrymen, unquote. Since the topic was revived, however, the paper addressed the Irish leader's condemnation of American slavery, saying he had little understanding of a system he had never seen and that he had been ignorant of the practical difficulties surrounding it. The Boston Pilot responded in a similar manner, claiming that O'Connell did not understand the constitutional limits attacking slavery. It's kind of funny because the Pilot actually praised his anti-slavery sentiments. It called it the best contribution yet made to anti-slavery literature. But it said that O'Connell had put a lasting blot on his character as a great constitutional lawyer in the assertions he made, that it could be ended. The Pilot's editorial posited that O'Connell would have regretted his abolitionist speeches if he had lived to see the, quote, useless slaughter of hundreds of thousands of men and the rupture of the grandest republic ever formed over the slavery issue. Discussion of O'Connell's Cincinnati letter continued among the Irish press, but it also was reprinted and discussed in the abolitionist press and in the Republican Party press. There's a big Republican Party broadside that was posted throughout New York City after the draft riots that had quotes from O'Connell's words on it, trying to entreat Irish Americans to support Republican Party policies, especially emancipation. And thus, his anti-slavery legacy became an important point of debate among the Catholic community of the Northeast and especially among Irish Catholics after the Emancipation Proclamation and the draft riots especially. So his anti-slavery memory was a little different for Irish Americans than it had been for the abolitionists. The third thing I want to discuss are African Americans and how they used his memory. Very interesting subject. 19th century spokesman for the African-American community, as you can probably imagine, made a lot of the same arguments about O'Connell that the abolitionists did. They lifted him up in a similar way, saying he was a symbol of one unwilling to compromise his ideals, and they contrasted him to Irish-American position, the position on slavery and race. But in addition, black leaders found in O'Connell's memory parallels between Irish uplift and their own struggle with black rights in America. And they paid special attention to the debt that they felt as African Americans that they owed him for supporting their rights. They took seriously O'Connell's comment that African Americans needed some black O'Connell, and throughout the post-war era in particular, they linked their own cause to that of Ireland, while at the same time expressing appreciation for O'Connell's anti-slavery legacy. Examples abound. In 1848, Henry Highland Garnet, who was a prominent black abolitionist, spoke out saying that people could learn a lot from O'Connell, and he proposed that African Americans hold their own monster meetings, as O'Connell had held in Ireland. He had these big monster meetings that attracted, you know, great crowds, and he spoke on behalf of Irish repeal, and he said we should do the same thing to promote black solidarity and racial justice. In 1863, another black abolitionist, Robert Purvis, spoke out about his legacy. He recounted he had traveled to England and met O'Connell on his visit in England. He was quite light-skinned, and so when he met O'Connell, O'Connell asked him if he supported slavery or not, and he was like, no, I don't. So when he said no, he did not support slavery, he reached out his hand to shake his hand. Purvis said that he would take that lesson home, and after kind of complaining about the Irish Americans, as he called them, quote, the bitterest enemies of freedom and of the black man, he pledged to treat them the same as O'Connell had treated him and asked them if they supported slavery or not, and if they didn't condemn the institution, he would declare, I want nothing to do with you, you are the enemies of God and the human race. But if they expressed sympathy towards human freedom, he said he would take their hand as O'Connell had his. In 1874, a man named John M. Langston, who was a black professor, this is after the war, from Howard University, gave a speech on O'Connell to a Catholic congregation in Washington, D.C. The speech was on the life and character of Daniel O'Connell. In it, he compared O'Connell to William Lloyd Garrison as one of the best friends to African Americans. He drew parallels, this is interesting, between America's revolution and the Irish struggle for political liberty from Great Britain. He, and we'll see later, a lot of people made a lot out of the fact that O'Connell was born in 1775 during the period of the American Revolution, and he kind of embodied that spirit of liberty that is associated with the revolution. And so, and when they celebrated O'Connell later on, they said he was an American in spirit because of when he was born and because of his ideals. So he drew parallels between America's revolution and the Irish struggle for political liberty from Great Britain, saying that all Americans should support popular government in Ireland. And the African American in particular, he said, inspired by his new life of freedom, should reach out to Ireland because the colored American is too sensible of his debt of gratitude to O'Connell and the great leaders of the Irish people to be unsympathetic or indifferent to Ireland's struggles and condition. There are many examples of this kind of rhetoric among African Americans, but it's Frederick Douglass who is most associated with African American memories of O'Connell. Indeed, references to O'Connell's anti-slavery legacy and the parallels between the Irish and the black condition can be found throughout Douglass's speeches and writings. The connection between the two came in 1845. Douglass traveled to Ireland. He was like 28 at the time, 27 or 28. O'Connell was 70. And this was just 2 years before O'Connell's death and right at the beginning of the famine. So it was quite a momentous year. He traveled in 1845 and he met with O'Connell while he was there, and the 2 men expressed mutual admiration. O'Connell introduced Douglass as the black O'Connell during his visit to audiences. And in later years, Douglass would often write about his memories of meeting with elderly O'Connell and helping to preserve a useful memory of O'Connell for African Americans. O'Connell's visit to Ireland not only acquainted him with Douglass's visit to Ireland acquainted him not only with O'Connell, but awakened him to similarities in the condition of the oppressed Irish and that of the African American. And he spoke quite often on this subject throughout his life. One can find references to Ireland in his speeches from the 1850s well into the 1880s, comparing the two. In addition, numerous mentions of the subject can be found in the newspapers edited by Douglass throughout his lifetime. The North Star, Frederick Douglass's paper, great title for a paper, right? And Douglass's Monthly contain references to O'Connell in connection with a range of subjects, from the colonizing of African Americans to Liberia, to the visit of Irish Catholic temperance advocate Father Matthew, to the Emancipation Proclamation and the draft rights of 1863. He also brought O'Connell up when he spoke out against segregation and for equal rights after the Civil War as well. So far, I've been discussing how African Americans, Irish Americans, and abolitionists helped to preserve the memories of O'Connell's abolitionism, and we've seen a little bit of conflict there. Now I want to look at the O'Connell Centennial of August 1875 and look at how all these groups came together to celebrate O'Connell. At the celebrations, they were united by the desire to memorialize the Irish leader as one who spoke against oppression in a universal way. So they borrowed a lot of the language that we saw the abolitionists use about him as a cosmopolitan reformer. And he was celebrated, his centennial obviously was celebrated throughout the world because they're celebrating Great Britain and Ireland and all of the British Empire, all the way, Australia and such and Canada and in the United States. In the United States, he was held up in a very specific kind of way because, first of all, there's several reasons for this. There was a focus on the abolitionism and his commitment to universal man, as I mentioned, they often said. One, because they took place, the commemorations took place in 1775, and you'll see right next to the columns about the O'Connell Centennial throughout the Irish American press, columns about celebrating things like Bunker Hill, the centennial of the American Revolution. So they lifted him up as the ultimate Republican and a key promoter of the spread of Republican ideology. So that was one reason. Some of the accolades given to O'Connell made vague reference to his anti-slavery legacy as part of his cosmopolitan vision of uplift, but others were quite explicit, and attention to O'Connell's rhetoric on behalf of African Americans was revived as a result of the centennial. And that brings attention to another larger context within which the celebrations took place. On the heels of the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments of Reconstruction that had ended slavery, granted citizenship, equal rights, and the vote to African American males, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act in 1775, same time outlawing segregation. Now, sadly, this would later be struck down by the Supreme Court in the 1880s. But for a time, there was a real commitment to African American rights. And so that was happening the same year that they were celebrating O'Connell's centennial. And so the connection between O'Connell and African-American rights was of great interest to the countrymen at this time in the northern United States. He wasn't celebrated as much in the South, but he was celebrated in Baltimore and Washington, D.C., who had been slave-owning areas. Although the O'Connell Centennial celebrations were held under the auspices mainly of Irish and Catholic organizations, Americans from a broad demographic participated in them, and blacks were included in many cities. And in fact, they were explicitly invited to attend a number of the celebrations. You know, quite interestingly, in Baltimore, they were invited to attend, which had been, Maryland, a slave-owning area. In some places, African Americans played a more active role in celebrating O'Connell. In Cincinnati, The National Conference of Colored Men held its own celebration of O'Connell as a friend of humanity. They gathered, they said, in order to recall with gratitude his eloquent and effective pleas for the freedom of our race and to commend his example to our countrymen. In St. Paul, Minnesota, African Americans and Irish Americans planned a joint celebration of O'Connell, and one of the main speakers at their event was Robert Banks, who was a black barber who had once met O'Connell. The National Republican newspaper, in Washington, D.C., reported on the activities in Minnesota, remarking that the celebration passed off quietly and that the most interesting feature of the proceedings was the fraternization of the colored and Irish citizens, which was hearty and complete. So they're expressing real amazement at this coming together of Irish Americans and African Americans. So it's a notable celebration that was mentioned in quite a bit of the press. But one of the most remarkable celebrations took place in Boston. In that city, O'Connell's anti-slavery activities were central to the tribute to O'Connell, and there was a coming together of Irish Americans, abolitionists, and African Americans to celebrate those activities. The celebration, interestingly, was arranged by Patrick Donahue, who had been the editor of the Boston Pilot that had been so critical of both O'Connell and the abolitionists. O'Connell's abolitionist views, that is, and the abolitionists throughout the antebellum and Civil War period, and now he's chairing the planning committee, and who do they invite to be the main speaker? Wendell Phillips, who they had been insisting he'd be arrested for treason, and he had been the object of a lot of derision. He was the keynote speaker that Donahue and these Irish Americans, in most of the planning committees in all of the towns, and he was celebrated just far and wide. They tended to be a coming together of representatives of various Catholic and Irish organizations, and they would have these kind of joint Irish-Catholic kind of planning committee. But here they made a very big effort to link it to anti-slavery, which is really interesting. So they had Wendell Phillips there as the main speaker. Abolitionist poet John Greenleaf Whittier spoke. William Lloyd Garrison spoke. And his colleague James Buffum is another abolitionist. Garrisonian abolitionists participated. Not only did they invite white abolitionists, but they also invited a black speaker, George T. Downing, who is a big black orator in Boston, and a number of, according to the Pilot, quote, a number of other colored gentlemen of the city. So these men shared the stage with the Irish American leaders of the city, and some of the prominent spokesmen like John Boyle O'Reilly and Johnny Fitzgerald, no relation to the later Johnny Fitzgerald that's related to John F. Kennedy, preceded him. But speakers at the Boston commemoration celebrated both O'Connell's work for Ireland and his abolitionism, and they all lifted up his commitment to universal liberty, and they're all sharing stage. This is quite remarkable in 1775 when these groups had been kind of at each other for the decades previously. So the celebrations revealed a great shift in sentiment in the city where some of the most vehement conflicts between abolitionists and Irish Americans had taken place. One reason for the show of cooperation found in the Boston celebration was the participation of Irish nationalist poet and journalist John Boyle O'Reilly. O'Reilly arrived in the United States in 1869. A former Fenian, O'Reilly had been transported to Australia by the British government, and like John Mitchell had before him, he made his escape to American shores, where he became a prominent newspaper columnist who promoted Irish independence. But unlike Mitchell, and by the way, interestingly, Mitchell died in the year that these celebrations were taking place in 1875. Unlike Mitchell, O'Reilly promoted a more liberal position among Irish Americans concerning African Americans. After O'Reilly arrived on American shores, he soon became acting editor of the Boston Pilot, which was owned by Patrick Donahue, but he had taken a break from editorial activities at this time. And Donahue, by the way, had all the, he had advertised in the Boston Pilot throughout this year. They had busts of O'Connell for sale and pictures and such. There's a great kind of production of O'Connell memorabilia, if you will, for this time. Under O'Reilly's leadership, the paper distanced itself from its anti-abolitionist past, and it became one of the top Northeastern vehicles for the promotion of African-American rights. During the 1870s and especially in the 1880s, O'Reilly linked Irish and black struggles for equality and proposed that the two groups should join together to battle oppression of all kinds. During the 1880s, in fact, African Americans and Irish Americans became involved in one another's independence movement in the North to an increasing degree. African Americans paid attention to the Irish ability to organize, promote ethnic solidarity, and raise money. And O'Connell's nonviolent political agitation was lifted up as a model by African Americans who now had the vote. For their part, Irish leaders like O'Reilly attacked the idea that Irish Americans and African Americans were somehow in competition with one another, and they promoted the idea that both groups would have more strength for the working man if they joined together to promote uplift for both their communities. If they voted together, they could be a powerful, powerful force. Thus, during the 1880s, African American leaders like Douglas and George T. Downing, by the way, who I mentioned, spoke at the centennial. He also continued advocating this position in the 1880s. Promoted, and John Boyle O'Reilly and other Irish American leaders promoted racial reconciliation between Irish Americans and African Americans. And O'Reilly, in fact, some saw him as the successor to the previously maligned Wendell Phillips, who died in the, I think, early 1880s, becoming known as one of the most prominent white spokesmen for African American rights. He argued for racial equality and anti-segregation, and he even advocated racial intermarriage, which was a taboo subject among most white Americans at the time. So I'd like to end my talk where I began, with the linked memories of Frederick Douglass and Daniel O'Connell. In June of 1863, Douglass gave a speech on the present and future of the colored race in America. Drawing a parallel between the Irish and American freedom struggles, he referenced the Irish leader, saying, "Daniel O'Connell once said that the history of Ireland might be traced like a wounded man through a crowd by the blood." And he asserted that one could do the same for black Americans. Douglass was actually very fond of this metaphor of O'Connell's. He referred to it on a number of occasions throughout the 1850s when he wished to draw a parallel between the Irish and the African-American condition. And he continued to make use of that figure of speech in later years, well into the 1880s, when he spoke of the history of the African-American freedom struggle. The phrase, in fact, became so associated with Frederick Douglass that in the 1960s, Martin Luther King attributed it to Douglass when he himself linked the black freedom struggle for civil rights as leaving a trail of blood. This talks about the memory of Daniel O'Connell, not Frederick Douglass, but it's worth noting that the image of Douglass in Ireland is sort of a mirror of what O'Connell was for the United States in the years after his death. As Obama's mention of him earlier this year illustrates, his connection with Ireland through the memory of Daniel O'Connell has served as a link between the freedom struggle in Ireland and that of African Americans. The Irish continue to memorialize Douglass over there. In Belfast, there's one of their murals. They have a mural of Frederick Douglass with some things that draw, a little quotation that draws a parallel between black rights and Irish Catholic rights. There's a monument to him in Dublin. And while Obama was visiting, they unveiled a new monument to Douglass in Cork in May 2011. So Douglass has meaning over there, as O'Connell kind of had meaning over here. So Obama's reference to the friendship between the two men may have been a slight overstatement, for the two men had only a brief meeting with one another, but O'Connell definitely influenced Douglass and countless others in the way they conducted themselves in their own reform efforts in the years after the Irish liberator's death. They borrowed his techniques, they lifted up his unwillingness to compromise, his broad vision of reform, and they used his legacy to appeal to Irish Americans to support justice for African Americans. Through the efforts of memorializing O'Connell's contributions to the anti-slavery movement, they provided a symbolic connection between Ireland and the African American that was important not only in the years surrounding America's 19th century conflict over slavery and racial equality, but one that's endured through present day.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life. And thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.